All right, let's dive into a case today that really highlights the potential pitfalls of sharing a lawyer, especially when you're facing serious criminal charges alongside multiple co-defendants.
We're talking about Kyler v. Sullivan, right?
Exactly. Kyler v. Sullivan, a landmark Supreme Court case that set the stage for how courts handle conflicts of interest in those multi-defendant cases.
Yeah, it's a case that's had a ripple effect throughout the legal system.
It's shaped how defense attorneys approach their ethical duties, how courts look at these potential conflicts, and how defendants, you know, people like you and me, understand our own rights.
Definitely a case worth understanding, for sure.
Absolutely. So to kick things off, let's rewind back to the story behind Kyler v. Sullivan. What exactly happened that landed this case in front of the highest court in the land?
Well, we're going back to 1973 Philadelphia. A pretty grim scene unfolds: a triple murder at the headquarters of Teamsters Local 107. Yeah, not a pretty picture. John Sullivan and two other guys are indicted for this crime. And this is where things get a bit, well, complicated. All three of them decided to share the same two lawyers for their defense.
So they pooled their resources, I guess figuring it would be more cost-effective to have the same legal team. Did they not anticipate any potential issues with this setup?
Well, you know, hindsight is 20/20. Back then, the implications of joint representation weren't as clear-cut as they are today. But the real twist came later when Sullivan was tried separately from his co-defendants.
Okay.
He ended up being convicted, while the other two guys, remember, represented by the same lawyers, were later acquitted.
Wow. Talk about a bad break for Sullivan. So the guy who goes to trial first, sharing lawyers with two others involved in the same crime, gets convicted while they walk free. That definitely raises some serious eyebrows about whether his defense was truly effective, you know, whether he got a fair shake.
Exactly. And that's precisely the issue that the Supreme Court grappled with in Kyler. Did sharing lawyers create a conflict of interest that worked against Sullivan?
All right, so before we delve into the court's decision, let's clarify some legal fundamentals for our listeners. When we talk about a defendant's right to effective counsel, what exactly do we mean?
Okay, so the Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, it guarantees everyone the right to the assistance of counsel. Basically, this means you have a right to a lawyer, and not just any lawyer, but one who's competent, who can adequately represent your interests, defend you against those charges.
Gotcha. So whether you're shelling out big bucks for a high-powered attorney or relying on a court-appointed lawyer, you're still entitled to this basic protection.
Right, and that's a point the Supreme Court really hammered home in Kyler. They said the Sixth Amendment applies regardless of how you get your lawyer. State action, it's inherently part of a criminal trial. So those constitutional safeguards, those are always in play.
That's a crucial point for defendants to understand.
Yeah.
Now, the second big question the court tackled in Kyler was about the standard for proving that a conflict of interest actually violated someone's Sixth Amendment rights. How do you prove that a conflict of interest actually hurt your case?
Right. The court laid out a two-part test. To prove a Sixth Amendment violation because of a conflict of interest, a defendant has to show two things. One, that there was a real, an actual conflict, not just a potential one. And two, that this conflict actually had a negative effect, an adverse effect on the lawyer's performance.
Adversely affected.
Right.
So you can't just speculate, right? You need hard evidence that the conflict actually messed with how the lawyer handled the case. How does this compare to the prejudice standard we see in other Sixth Amendment cases, like Strickland v. Washington? You know, the idea that the lawyer's actions actually changed the outcome of the trial.
You're spot on to bring up Strickland. It's an important comparison. In Strickland, to show you had ineffective assistance of counsel, you've got to demonstrate that the lawyer screwed up so badly that it prejudiced the outcome. You got to show that with a better lawyer, there's a reasonable chance the result would have been different.
So Strickland really focuses on how the lawyer's actions impacted the result, the final verdict.
Precisely. It requires a higher burden of proof. In Kyler, it's a bit different. You don't have to prove that the outcome would have been different. You still got to show the conflict really did affect what the lawyer did, but you don't have to go as far as proving it would have changed the verdict, like in Strickland.
Okay, so the bar in Kyler is higher than just pointing out a theoretical conflict, but not as high as proving the outcome would have been different. Why do you think the court went with this approach?
It's a balancing act, really. They wanted to make sure defendants get effective representation, that their Sixth Amendment rights are protected. But at the same time, they didn't want to make it super easy to overturn convictions based on just what-ifs, right? Mm-hmm. You know, conflicts, they pop up in multi-defendant cases all the time. If they made the standard too low, the courts would be flooded with appeals.
Makes sense. So finding that sweet spot between upholding rights but not throwing the system into chaos. Now, how did the court apply this adverse effect standard to Sullivan's case? Did they actually determine if his lawyer was conflicted?
Well, here's the thing. The Supreme Court didn't actually rule on whether Sullivan's lawyer had a conflict or not. They sent the case back to the lower courts to apply this new standard.
So we don't know what ultimately happened to Sullivan.
Right. The end of his story isn't the main point. The court's reasoning, the logic they laid out, that's what matters. Kyler gave us the guidelines, the rules of the road for dealing with potential conflicts.
Okay, so let's dig into those guidelines. What were the key points the justices highlighted?
All right, so Justice Powell, he wrote the majority opinion, and he emphasized that trial courts, they don't have to go on a witch hunt for potential conflicts. They don't have to investigate unless it's glaringly obvious that something's amiss. The main responsibility for spotting and raising potential conflicts, that rests with defense lawyers.
So it's on the lawyers to be proactive, to be super vigilant about potential conflicts.
Exactly. It's their ethical duty. It's not just about following the letter of the law. It's about upholding those professional standards, acting in the best interests of their clients.
But what if those standards aren't met? What if the lawyers miss a clear conflict and it ends up hurting their client? Doesn't that trigger the Sixth Amendment's protection?
It might, but remember, just showing there could have been a conflict, that's not enough. You need proof that the conflict actually messed with how the lawyer handled the case, that adverse effect we talked about. The court was crystal clear on that.
Okay, so back to that adverse effect standard. Now, were there any other opinions on this? Any concurring or dissenting voices that added to the conversation?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Justice Brennan, he agreed with sending the case back down to the lower courts, but he made an interesting point in his concurrence. He felt that trial judges, they should be more upfront about explaining the risks of joint representation to defendants.
It's kind of like a warning label, like, hey, sharing a lawyer could have these consequences.
Yeah, exactly. Just to make sure defendants are making a truly informed choice.
Makes sense. Transparency is key, especially when someone's freedom is on the line. Were there any justices who flat out disagreed with the majority?
Justice Marshall, he dissented. He argued that the standard of proof, the whole adverse effect thing, it put too much burden on defendants. He thought just proving there was an actual conflict, that should be enough to prove a Sixth Amendment violation.
So he wanted a more defendant-friendly approach, basically saying, look, if there's a conflict, that's enough. We don't need to dissect how it played out.
Right. He pointed out that it's tough for defendants to go back and reconstruct what happened, you know, what decisions the lawyer made and why, especially if the lawyer didn't keep good records.
Yeah, I can see his point. It can be hard to prove after the fact that a conflict messed things up. But the majority, they seemed more worried about a flood of appeals, right?
For sure. They didn't want to open the floodgates and make it too easy to challenge convictions. They were trying to balance protecting individual rights with the practicalities of the legal system.
Trying to find that middle ground, that makes sense. Now, all this legal back and forth is fascinating, but let's bring it down to earth a bit. How has Kyler actually changed things in the real world? What lasting impact has it had on lawyers, courts, and, you know, everyday people facing charges?
Oh, it's been a game changer. Kyler has had a major impact, especially when you've got multiple defendants in the mix. Let's start with defense attorneys. For them, it's a huge wake-up call, a reminder that they can't just ignore potential conflicts.
So they can't just bury their heads in the sand and hope for the best.
Not if they want to stay on the right side of the law and their ethical obligations. Kyler really underscores the importance of spotting potential conflicts early on and being transparent about them.
So being upfront with the court, and of course with their clients, what about the courts? How has Kyler changed their role in all of this?
For courts, it's like, hey, we're not mind readers. They don't have to play detective and try to uncover every possible conflict. Their duty to investigate, it's limited to those situations where the red flags are waving, you know, where it's undeniable that a conflict exists.
So a more hands-off approach, unless it's absolutely clear that there's a problem. What's the big takeaway for defendants, for the folks who are actually caught up in the system?
If you're a defendant, especially in a case with multiple defendants, Kyler teaches you to speak up early, you know, if you have any worries about sharing a lawyer. Don't wait until after you're convicted to say something. Remember, proving a Sixth Amendment violation after the fact, that's a tough uphill battle.
That's good advice. Don't stay silent if you're feeling uneasy about your representation. Now, to make sure I'm following all this, let's break down the difference between an actual conflict and a potential conflict. Can you give me a real-world example to illustrate this?
Absolutely. Let's say we've got two guys charged with robbery, right? They're sharing a lawyer to save some money, but then one of them decides to cooperate with the prosecution and testify against his buddy. Now the lawyer's in a real bind.
Ooh, yeah. Sounds like a classic conflict of interest scenario.
It is. The lawyer can't really grill the guy who's cooperating without potentially hurting the case of the other client. This isn't just some hypothetical possibility. It's playing out right there in the courtroom. The lawyer is torn, trying to serve two masters, and his actions are directly influenced by the competing interests of his clients.
Okay, that's a crystal clear example of an actual conflict in action. Now, earlier you said that lawyers have an ethical duty to avoid conflicts, but courts only step in when those conflicts are, like, undeniable. Can you unpack that a little?
Sure. Think of it this way. Lawyers, they have a professional code, a set of rules they have to follow. Part of that is acting in the best interests of their clients and avoiding conflicts that could mess that up. Courts, on the other hand, their focus is on making sure the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to a good lawyer is protected.
So the ethical rules for lawyers might be stricter than the constitutional standards the courts are enforcing.
Yeah, you could say that. A lawyer could violate their ethical duties even if their actions don't quite rise to the level of a Sixth Amendment violation. Like a small conflict that doesn't really impact their representation, that could still be an ethical no-no.
That clears up the distinction between those ethical rules and the constitutional stuff. Now, you also mentioned another case earlier, Holloway v. Arkansas. How does that tie into all of this?
Holloway is a good contrast to Kyler. In Holloway, the Supreme Court said that if a defendant objects to joint representation during the trial and the trial court ignores them, then prejudice is presumed. They don't have to prove an actual conflict and an adverse effect. The burden shifts.
So, speaking up early, voicing your concerns about sharing a lawyer, that can make a big difference. In Kyler, Sullivan didn't object until after his conviction, and that put him in a tough spot.
Exactly. Holloway shows the importance of being proactive, of asserting your right to a lawyer who's solely on your side right from the get-go.
That's a powerful lesson for anyone facing criminal charges, especially when there are multiple defendants involved. Knowing your rights and understanding the risks of sharing a lawyer, that could be game-changing. But before we wrap up this deep dive, I have one last question for you.
Well, if you're in that situation, facing charges alongside other people, the first thing you got to ask yourself is how similar are your defenses?
Okay.
If you and your co-defendants are telling completely different stories, or even worse, planning to blame each other, sharing a lawyer is a recipe for disaster.
That makes perfect sense. The more your interests clash, the higher the chance of a conflict popping up. What else should defendants keep in mind?
The severity of the charges, that matters too. In a complicated case, you know, where the stakes are really high, having a lawyer who's 100% focused on your defense, that could be make or break.
So basically, the more serious the charges, the more you want a lawyer who's all in for, not dividing their attention.
Absolutely. And don't forget about the lawyer's experience and reputation. A seasoned attorney who's handled a bunch of multi-defendant cases, they might be better equipped to navigate those choppy waters.
And not just about finding any good lawyer. It's about finding the right lawyer for this specific situation.
Exactly. And at the end of the day, trust your gut. If you have any doubts about sharing a lawyer, any uneasiness at all, don't ignore it. Better safe than sorry when your freedom's hanging in the balance.
Words to live by. It's your life, your future, so make sure you feel good about the person representing you.
You got it. Ultimately, whether or not to share a lawyer, it's a personal call. There's no magic formula.
But being informed about the risks, knowing what Kyler v. Sullivan tells us, that's crucial. It gives us a framework for understanding those potential conflicts. It reminds us about the Sixth Amendment and those challenges that pop up when you've got multiple defendants in the mix.
It's a case that every lawyer, every law student, should know inside and out. It's a lesson in ethics, in constitutional rights, and that delicate balance between protecting individual defendants and keeping the system fair.
Couldn't have said it better myself. A huge thanks to our expert for taking us through all the ins and outs of this landmark case. And to our listeners, you know, this has been a deep dive into Kyler v. Sullivan, and I feel like I've got a much better handle on this whole conflict of interest thing now.
It's definitely a case worth knowing.
Absolutely. But before we wrap things up, I've got one last question for you. If you were a defendant facing a complicated case, and there were other people charged alongside you, what would you think about when deciding whether to share a lawyer or get your own?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? It's a tough call, and every situation is different. But here are a few things I'd definitely weigh. First off, how much do your defenses overlap?
Okay.
If you and the other defendants are telling completely different stories, or even worse, planning on pointing fingers at each other, sharing a lawyer is asking for trouble.
Yeah, that makes sense. The more your interests clash, the bigger the risk of a conflict.
Exactly. And the severity of the charges, that plays a role too. In a complex case with serious consequences, having a lawyer who's solely dedicated to you, that could be critical.
So the higher the stakes, the more you want a lawyer who's 100% on your side.
No doubt about it. And you can't forget about the lawyer's experience. Someone who's handled a lot of multi-defendant cases, they might be better at navigating those potential conflicts.
So finding the right lawyer for the specific situation, not just any good lawyer.
Exactly. And finally, trust your gut. If you have any hesitation at all about sharing a lawyer, listen to that inner voice. It's better to be safe than sorry when your freedom is on the line.
That's some solid advice. Well, folks, there you have it, a deep dive into Kyler v. Sullivan. We've explored its twists and turns, how it's changed legal practice, and the lessons it holds for everyone involved in the criminal justice system.
It's a case that really drives home the importance of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel and those tricky situations that come up when multiple defendants are involved.
A huge thanks to our expert for guiding us through this legal maze. And to our listeners, remember, knowledge is power. Stay informed, stay engaged, and keep fighting for your rights. Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp.